Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update. Here we are at the transition from July to August 2015, and we have again a program devoted, as always, to the economic dimensions of our lives, jobs, incomes, debts, all of that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, been a professor of economics all my adult life, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. I'll have more to say later in the program about a variety of services and alerts I would like to provide to you, but let's jump right in with some of the last week's events that we can make some hopefully interesting comments about. Well, the first is a case of economic blackmail. In this case, the blackmailer is the Boeing Corporation, the American producer of airplanes. McInerney, a fellow who runs that enterprise, basically threatened this last week that if he didn't get the Export-Import Bank renewal that the Congress is debating, a program in which the federal government basically subsidizes exports, makes it easy for foreigners with cheap loans and so on to buy American goods, that unless that is done, unless his company gets this subsidized market for its goods, he might be leaving the United States to produce airplanes in countries that do provide that kind of incentive, let's call it, or let's be less polite, bribery. Government bribery to get the companies to locate there. This is a game that large corporations love to play. Every country is pitted against every other, and the company goes to the country that gives them the most at, of course, the expense of their taxpayers. What Mr. McInerney wants is taxpayer money used to subsidize his company's exports or to reduce it down to its essentials. Our taxes to make his profits higher, and threatens the United States, all of us, if we don't do it. Let's see, Boeing has 165,000 employees and is active in 65 countries, so it's in a great position. It has a lot of people it could throw out of work in any given country it wishes to punish, and a lot of jobs to tangle in front of a country it wishes to get more subsidies from. This is nothing short of what I called it, economic blackmail. And to allow companies to continue to do this is to put all of the rest of us, the people, not just in the United States, but in every other desperate country trying to either hold on to or to induce the arrival of a company, to compete against one another. So all taxpayers in all countries are fleeced for the private profits of capitalist corporate giants. Another update. Something interesting is happening, even though it upsets all kinds of people. Capitalism, which was telling us through its spokespeople for the last several decades that socialism had been defeated. The collapse of the Soviet Union was interpreted to mean that in some great struggle between capitalism and socialism, capitalism had won, socialism had lost, and now would become, at best, a historical oddity of shrinking interest. How distressing for the folks who like capitalism that this fairy tale has now been decisively put to rest. And where? Well, actually in many countries, but I want to pick the examples that are becoming important now in the two countries where you might have expected at least, the United States and Great Britain. In both of those countries, a candidate for very high office who is clearly, openly and unabashedly a socialist is doing way better than all of the folks who'd like to believe that fairy tale would have imagined possible. Here in the United States, it is, of course, Bernie Sanders running inside the Democratic Party, but as a quote-unquote independent and as a socialist and making the kinds of comments and statements that have traditionally been associated with the socialist alternative. And in the United Kingdom, very similarly, in the race for the leader of the Labour Party, which is, after all, the opposition party, the second party, a party that has been in power in Great Britain quite often since the Second World War, the leadership struggle for that party among four candidates, that the leader turns out to be Jeremy Corbyn, a traditional socialist who doesn't shy away from it, who is proud of it, and who says that England needs to change radically, and that he, as a socialist, competing to be head of the Labour Party, is the person to do it. Well, wow. What can we say about this beyond that socialism is rising? It's a simple point. Socialism is the critique of capitalism. That's what it has always been. Sometimes, when socialists got into positions of power, socialism became something else as well. A plan or a program for how to develop a country in a non-capitalist way. So socialism has been this sort of half the critique of capitalism, half the alternative to it. And there are a lot of problems that socialism has had along the way. But here's one thing that's clear. Capitalism, too, has produced staggering problems. Problems of instability, those every few years crashes that throw people out of work and that set back an economy often for decades. Inequality, pitting upper income against middle income against lower income, creating middle classes only to throw them back on the slag heap of poverty shortly thereafter. Capitalism has its share of problems, to say the least. The 20th century, arguably the height of capitalism's success so far, is also the century in which we had two world wars fought out among capitalist countries, by and large, certainly started by them, and that's not something that the system called capitalism would actually praise in itself, would it? So guess what? A system with instability problems, inequality problems, war problems, generates criticism, generates opposition. Socialism is the major name for the major opposition, or maybe we should be better saying oppositions, plural, that capitalism has always created. Socialism, communism, Marxism, anarchism, those are shadows of capitalism, and capitalism can no more get rid of them than you and I can get rid of our shadows. It's the way capitalism works. And socialists, therefore, will be with us. And when capitalism produces the kind of inequality it's producing now, and shows the kind of instability, for example, the crash since 2008, and the failure to recover in most places from it, when capitalism shows us its dirty laundry in that way, are we really supposed to be surprised that socialism is renewed, revives, shows its mettle, makes its critiques, explores the alternatives it might be able to establish? Of course not. It was only a matter of time that it would happen in the United States and in Great Britain. And here it is, Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, and it renews a real political debate. Not a detail over this or that, but a real debate about economic systems, what kind we want to live on, what kind we want to depend on, which is long overdue anyway. Next update. We had really a tragic story this last week. The United States government levied a fine on the Chrysler Corporation. Actually, these days, because of the merger between Chrysler and the Fiat Corporation in Italy, it's called the Fiat Chrysler Automobile Company, FCA. And it was hit with a fine. And there were lots of stories, television, radio, newspaper stories about the big fine. To be precise, $105 million. Well, what was the fine for? Two things in the main. Truck and SUVs produced by Chrysler turn out to have defective suspensions that would mean that drivers could and did lose control of the cars. Second major issue, the Jeep, which is a Chrysler brand. Jeeps had fire-prone gas tanks. That is, if you had a crash particularly or some other kind of malfunction, the gas tank could explode in flames, which you don't need an advanced degree to know, not a good thing to have happen. How bad was it? Well, it's a little hard to tell. Here's what we know. Over 50, that's a lovely number, isn't it? Over 50 people were killed by these, one or the other of these defects. In the words of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Chrysler had failed, here's the language, failed to execute 23 recalls of defective vehicles. And how many vehicles were defective or at risk of being defective? 11 million. 11 million cars. Well, I did arithmetic because I learned that in school. I said, let's see. 11 million cars had defects or might have had defects and that were to be recalled for the safety, life and death safety, we might add, of the passengers and the drivers. And they were fined $105 million. You know what that works out to? 11 million cars sent out to the public over quite a few years by Chrysler that put their drivers at risk. That works out to $9.55 a car. That's what Chrysler was fined. And the headlines talked about very big fine, very heavy fine, $9.55 per car. So I did a little more arithmetic. I asked myself, how much was the total revenue of the Fiat Chrysler Corporation, Fiat Chrysler Automobiles, last year? Answer, over $100 billion. How much was the fine? $105 million. I worked that out. That's 1/10 of 1%. Not 1%. Not 0.5%. 1/10 of 1% was this fine. If ever you wanted an example of how the car companies control the government, so that even when they kill more than 50 people and fail to recall, being ordered to do so, fail to execute the recalls, and put 11 million car drivers at risk, they're given a fine of $9.55. Nothing I say, nothing, would be adequate to such a story. Next update, moving right along, as they say. Airline tickets. You've probably noticed, if you do any travel with air, that over the last few years, a peculiar thing has been going on. The ticket prices for airlines have stayed roughly the same or often gone down. But meanwhile, fees charged by the airlines, and I mean fees for sitting near a window, fees for having a window or an exit area seat, fees for having your baggage checked, fees for you name it, have gone through the roof. Fees for things that never had a fee before. Fees raised. What's the story of fees? The answer is very, very simple. Partly, the airline companies are playing games with the public. They want to be able to advertise low ticket prices, get you interested, get you to make a plan, and then hit you with the fees, sometimes not until you literally get to the airport. But it turns out there's another reason. When airlines charge you money for a ticket, there's a federal excise tax. The government taxes airline tickets to raise some of the money that the government uses for school lunches, for the military, for all kinds of things that the government does. It's a way of funding the government. But it turns out that the airlines got themselves a nice law. Fees, unlike ticket prices, are not subject to the excise tax, a 7.5% tax that you don't have to pay for a fee, but you do have to pay for the airline ticket. So tickets stay the same, fees go up. We get to pay more, by the way. Airline companies are making profits in a way they haven't for years. The profits go up at the company, but we get stuck with higher prices and the government loses revenue. Since the government uses revenue in large part to take care of the public, here's how we can summarize this update. The public who rides airplanes is screwed by higher prices. The public, both those who ride airplanes and those who don't, is screwed because if the airlines pay less to the government because of the fee game, then the rest of us either have to make that up by paying more in taxes or we lose out on government services. Profits of the company go up. People and government, airline riders and public, are screwed. That's how our system works. Next, I've wanted to explain over and over again on this program why there's no recovery for the mass of people. And something came to my attention this last week, which shows us yet again how and why that's the case. The United Auto Workers, once the perhaps the most powerful union in the United States, but clearly not that anymore, largely because automobile companies have left the United States to produce in countries where they can pay much lower wages, where they often have no unions or have unions in name only, etc., etc. Starting July 13th, the United Auto Workers resumed negotiations with the car companies, again, chiefly General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, this time covering about 137,000 workers. That's what's left in the auto industry. And there they're struggling with what is in effect a three-tier system. See, it used to be that all workers got a decent wage. Up until around 7-8 years ago, that topped out at $28.69. First thing to notice. That's now called the top tier because other tiers, other levels, is another word for tier, were created. When the government bailed out General Motors and Chrysler, it got the union to agree to have workers working at different levels. So the old workers, the ones hired before 2007, still get $28.69. That hasn't been raised in 7 or 8 years. Let me say that again. That has been frozen. Since the prices of everything these people pay haven't been frozen and have risen, by one calculation, in terms of what you can afford to buy, the workers at the top have lost about $4 worth of their real income per hour over these last 7 or 8 years. But a lot of workers, 20-30% in many cases, are in the second tier, workers hired since 2007, who are allowed by the contract that was signed back then during the dark days of the crash. They are often doing the same work as the first tier, but they get paid $19.28. That's a lot less than $28.69. And they have an inferior health plan and so on. But the car companies have done another thing. They've outsourced certain jobs that used to be done by workers that they had hired that were members of the UAW. So, for example, janitors at Chrysler work for another company, and that is actually paid even less, the workers there, $11, between $11 and $14.88. So, in effect, you have three layers of workers. They're all members of the union. Two of them do interchangeably the same work, but they're paid radically different. This is, of course, a disaster for a union. Think of something that could do more damage to unity than having workers side by side spending the same dime doing the same thing and getting paid radically differently because a union agreed to something that it had not agreed to before. So it is the hope of many people watching these negotiations that the union will prevail in getting rid of this differential system, which shouldn't have been put into effect in the first place, should have been very short in its duration. And now that the car companies keep telling us their profits have resumed, heaven knows this should go. Because what it has done is meant that even people working in the automobile industry have not recovered from the crisis and have not recovered their situations from before 2007 and 2008, no matter how many times the press repeats its mantra of we're recovering. Let me turn now, in the time that we have, to responding to your questions. Several of you wrote in and asked me to comment on the fact that we are at the 50th anniversary this week of the Medicare system. Basically, a program that provides medical insurance, the government provides medical insurance to people over 65, using money that people, workers, contribute into the Medicare system, just as we contribute into the Social Security system that then pays us a pension when we get old. This is a medical insurance program. And 99% of the discussion of the Medicare program for elderly people, which we as working people pay for, has been a debate between conservatives and liberals, often but not exactly overlapping Republicans versus Democrats. And here's the debate, old, stale, and irrelevant that it is. On the one side, the conservatives. There shouldn't be government insurance. The private sector, you see, works better, is more efficient. This is an endless, stone-cold wrong argument that conservatives make over and over again because they're clearly convinced that repetition is the way you win an argument, not by looking at the facts, or certainly not by investigating the actual history. On the other side, the liberals, equally clear in their mind that things go better if the government runs the program. The government will do it better. The government will control costs better, etc. I was even taken aback that someone like Paul Krugman, a Nobel Prize winning economist, who's a liberal and a Democrat and all that, weighed in again, telling us that Medicare has been a better controller of costs than the private economy. He's, by the way, quite right that the cost of medical care when you insure through Medicare has not risen as fast as when you don't have Medicare insurance. When you rely on the private sector, you pay even more for the care we get in this country than if you're on Medicare. That's quite true. But here's why the argument is stale and really largely beside the point. We pay too much for medical care. We pay way more than other countries do. And I'm talking about other countries like Canada, Germany, France, Italy, Britain, you name it. We rely on a private economic system to provide medical care more than other countries do. Most other countries have mixtures of public and private. But we are mostly private, with the Medicare and Medicaid and the VA as our exceptions. So we are more private than everybody else, and we pay more than everybody else, way more. Do the results warrant this? Answer, no. Our medical results, age at which people die, number of children who die within the first year, average length of time in a hospital, we are mediocre in the care we give our people. Sure, the richest amongst us can get the best care, but that's not how you measure this. You measure in terms of the general medical care of our society. We pay more than everybody, and we get mediocre results. And that's because we have a private system. And why is it? We have four parts of our medical private industry capitalist system. doctors, hospitals, the producers of drugs and medical devices, and the insurers. They're all private. Private doctors, private hospitals, by and large, private insurance companies, by and large, and private producers of drugs, medicines, and medical devices. They get together and comprise a medical industrial complex, and they work closely together to give us the highest prices that medical care can cost anywhere on this planet, even though the results they deliver to us are, as I said, mediocre, nowhere near as good as in many other countries where they pay much less. Do we do something about this? No. To do something about it would be to have to attack that fundamental profit-driven medical system. We don't do that. Instead, we have old, stale, endlessly rehearsed debates. A little more government involvement is better or worse. A little more private is better or worse. My goodness, a debate that misses the basic point. Last question that we have time for today. I wish we had more, as I always do. People have asked me, how in the world would workers who wanted to take over a business, either because the company was threatening to leave, like Boeing, or the company was going to close down, or because the company's founder had no heirs who wanted to run the company, or the company simply lost interest, who knows? The idea is workers could take over. We ought to have a program in place in this country so that an employer could turn over his, her business when they didn't want to run it, for any reason, to their workers, to create in the United States a sector of worker-owned and operated, worker cooperatives, worker enterprises, whatever you want to call them. I like worker self-directed enterprises. Now, the answer to the question, is it feasible, is clearly and totally yes. And I want to take a very few minutes, actually I don't have even a minute, to give you an overview. First, there are laws in place for employee stock ownership plans, and very many other laws in place that provide state funds to make this kind of arrangements, or that allow the government to guarantee a bank to lend money to workers who want to take over an enterprise. That has been done thousands of times in the United States. That is not a weird idea, a new idea, a far-fetched idea, a future idea. That's here, that's ready to go. In future programs, I'm going to talk about other ways that the financing as well as the legal needs are available. Transition to worker-owned factories and offices and stores is something we can do, we should do, and the means for doing it are in place. Thank you very much for staying with me this half hour. We are going to shortly make a transition to the second half of the program. I want to be sure to also remind you of our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. But please stay with me. We will be back in a very short time for the second half of this program that I think will be of interest to you as well.
Shook it up. I never loved nobody fully. Always one foot on. And by protecting my heart truly, I got lost in the sounds I hear in my mind. All of these voices I hear in my mind. All of these words I hear in my mind. All of this music.
Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Before we begin, I want to remind you again that we maintain two websites, and we do that to serve you, our listeners and viewers. The websites contain articles, interviews, radio, television, entire courses, classes, lectures, on economic subjects of the sort we cover in the program and that we believe may be of great interest to you. They're available to you 24/7. We also produce a regular newsletter. It is absolutely free. If you go to the websites, it's easy to sign up. You will get the newsletters. We also ask you to think about following us on Facebook and Twitter. Once again, if you go to the two websites, whose address I'll give you in a moment, you can click on the icon and become associated with us through Twitter or Facebook or both, etc. The two websites are rdwolf with two F's .com and Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info. rdwolf.com, democracyatwork.info. Lastly, both websites allow you to communicate to us questions, comments, suggestions, criticisms, things you'd like me to talk about on the program. I do a great deal of speaking around the country. If you're listening in an area and you'd like me to bring me out there to do a public address, which have been very successful and I really like doing, get in touch with us. This is something that we do, and we have a system worked out for it, and we can help you even organize it in a variety of ways, which we're glad to do. And finally, we're always looking for more radio stations. We're now on nearly 50 across the United States, and we're looking to grow. If you're connected to, associated with, work at a community station, a college or university station, a public radio station of one kind or another, get in touch with us, and we would like to talk with you about carrying this program as part of what your station does. And if you're interested, again, go to the two websites and communicate that interest to us, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Okay, we're going to do two major topics in this half of the program that I think will interest you. The first has to do with the economic reality we now call China, People's Republic of China, the Chinese economy. It has been in the news a great deal. I'm going to talk about that and try to give everyone a sense of how and why the Chinese economy plays the role in the world that it does today. And when I'm done, I'm going to do the same thing for Germany, which, like China, has become and is continuing to play an ever greater role in the world economy alongside and in a complex relationship with the United States, etc. So first, China. China is an ancient civilization, as I'm sure many folks know, a rather large country unified by a culture and a language in a remarkable way. It had a long history of economic advance, more advanced than Europe and the West. Marco Polo, a famous explorer who brought back to Europe the information about a grand kingdom in the East, China, which in many ways was more advanced than Europe at that time in terms of its economy, what it produced, how it distributed what it produced, standard of living, and so on. But in the modern era, the West caught up and jumped ahead of China, doing then to China what China is now doing back to the West, as these things go. And for much of the last two or three centuries, until the middle of the 20th century, China was a relatively poor country, ripped off in a variety of ways by European colonial powers, the British, the French, the Germans, poaching pieces, particularly of the coastline of China. And it was a poor country suffering from imperialism and colonialism, like so many in the world had. Of particular note for Chinese modern economic history was the invasion back in 1931 by the expanding Japanese capitalist economy, which took over Manchuria, a highly developed northern part of China, waging war in China that was extremely destructive and lasted for many, many years, but provoked inside China a military and organized response. And part of that response, not all of it, but part of that response was a response by people who were not only anti-Japanese, because the Japanese had invaded and were a very tough political dominating power, but they were also anti-capitalist. They saw the Japanese invasion as partly the result of Japan having become a major capitalist power, and for them, the solution to China's problems meant getting rid of the Japanese and any other country that had invaded or threatened or taken over parts of China on the one hand, but also getting rid of the capitalism that for them was wrapped up in all of their suffering. Well, again, to make a long and complex story short, war was waged, world war basically, China entered against Japan, which put China in a kind of an alliance with the United States, which also fought against Japan, put the Chinese also in alliance with the Russians, the Communist Soviet Union, that also was fighting with the United States against Japan and Germany. When the war ended in 1945, the question was, which way would China go? And there were strong forces in China that wanted to make it a capitalist country like Japan, like the West, as the post-war, now that you got rid of the Japanese who were defeated, you could have an independent China that would become a capitalist country. That was one group wanted that. And another group said, no, we're staying with the old idea. We don't want foreigners, but we don't want capitalism either. The latter group, led by Mao Zedong, won. They had a civil war from 1945 till 1949, and in the end, the people who wanted capitalism, Chiang Kai-shek, their leader, not only lost the civil war with the communists, but they left China, went to an island, Taiwan, Formosa, not very far away, and established what they thought was a temporary government, which they called China, which would eventually come back and retake the mainland. This has turned out to be a fantasy, and no one in their right mind takes that seriously anymore. The communist Chinese under Mao solidified their rule in China, the most populous country in the world, and have basically been in control of that economic system ever since. At first, they were closely allied with their fellow anti-capitalist, socialist, communist country, the Soviet Union, but very quickly, in 1960, they fell apart. They disagreed about how to proceed, and they haven't been allies since. They're slowly trying to rebuild that alliance now. And let me now try to bring this to the modern time. The Chinese made a decision. Partly that was Mao, but particularly after Mao died. They made a decision to build their economy from the poor, relatively backward economy it had been to a modern economy by becoming an exporter. That is, they decided the best way forward for them was to produce goods for sale in the rest of the world. That had not been the decision made by the Soviet Union, partly because the Soviet Union was excluded from many markets and the Chinese had less of that as a problem, and partly it was ideological, a kind of sense of Stalin and the subsequent Soviet leaders that they had to build a kind of autarkic, self-focused economic system. The Chinese had the view, there were debates and disagreements among them, for sure, but they had the view that they could rebuild their economic system and grow to importance by becoming a powerhouse exporting economy, producing what the rest of the world would want to buy from China. Why? Because the Chinese were convinced, despite the fact that they were a poor, relatively undereducated, largely agricultural society, that they could make a fantastic transition from poor, backward agricultural to modern, urban, industrial in record time, if only they could have the market to buy the goods that they were so sure they could produce. Well, to make a long story short, this risky gamble as an economic strategy that many who observed it told them would not work, did work. And it worked better than even the Chinese leaders most committed to it ever imagined. Over the period, roughly, from the 1980s to the present, China went from a relatively poor, relatively backward, relatively agricultural country to a modern industrial export powerhouse. They did it with government-owned and operated enterprises, by and large. They did it as a socialist economy, if you define socialism as the government using a comprehensive economic plan controls the basic directions and functions of the economy. If that's the way you understand socialism, I personally don't, but many do, then this is a socialist economy that has been a staggering success. I have to drive that home because the economic growth of China, ranging, if you believe their numbers, which some do and some don't, range from 7% per year growth, which is staggering for most countries, up to 12 to 15%, which is off the charts for other countries. The United States and Britain think it's a good year if they get 3% growth. The Chinese would think that's a disaster. One of the reasons the Chinese is a powerhouse is if you can maintain rates of growth of 7% or more per year for decades, you are going to catch up with and surpass the United States, Britain, France, Japan, and so on, which is what the Chinese have been doing. They haven't surpassed them yet, but they have caught up in many, many ways. And even a casual visitor to the incredible cities that have sprung up across China, modern, skyscraper, industrial, sophisticated, etc., can see in a very short time what I'm talking about. Along the way, the Chinese made another decision different what the Soviets had done. And again, partly because there were opportunities the Chinese had that were never there for the Soviets. The Chinese made the decision to invite capitalist corporations from the West into China. They said to these corporations, look, we have very low wages in our country. Workers are able and willing to live at a standard of living your workers would never permit. They're willing to earn wages way lower than what your workers are willing to permit. And we're going to help you with fees and supports and transportation and infrastructure. We want you to come here. You will be a capitalist enterprise. You will operate independently. The government will not tell you what to do. You will be subject to the usual regulations that you are when you go to any country, but you will be free and you will make a fortune. You can produce here in China, paying much lower wages and often lower taxes and often fewer environmental and other regulations. And then you can ship your produce back to Europe, North America, Japan, and make a fortune because you can stay with your old prices or reduce them a little. Meanwhile, your costs, labor above all, have dropped to nothing by producing in China. Make a long story short, thousands and thousands of corporations around the world did it. They could see that if they didn't do it, their competitors would. And so, to avoid losing the competition, they joined. And the Chinese Communist government and Communist Party began to operate a complicated mixed system. Public enterprises owned, operated, and run by the Chinese government on the one hand, but alongside and interacting with private enterprises owned and operated by parent companies from North America, Western Europe, and Japan. So the Chinese economy became dependent on capitalism in these two ways. It brought capitalists in to the Chinese economy, banks included, and it was dependent for the success of its economic growth on the capitalist Japan, Western Europe, and North America, because that's to whom they sold the vast bulk of what they produced. And with this double reliance on capitalism, the Chinese were taking another big gamble. Because capitalism is an unstable system. It periodically has crashes, like the one in 2008. And that's going to affect the big mega corporations that the Chinese have allowed to enter their society, and it's going to affect their export markets that they've become dependent upon. So the Chinese economy is now a part of the world capitalist system, even though it has a lot of government control and a lot of government enterprise in their society, and it determined the Communist Party to stay in charge. But the recent downturn in the stock markets in China, which got a lot of attention over the last 2 or 3 weeks, should in fact surprise nobody. Because this is an economy that is so dependent in the two ways I've described on capitalism. The big companies that are now inside it. Just to give you an idea, roughly half of the goods from China that come into the United States, the clothing, the appliances, the machinery, and so on, are not Chinese in the sense we normally use that term. Yes, they are produced by Chinese workers in China. But those workers in China are employees of American companies. Half of what we bring from China is sold to us by American companies who went there to play this game because it makes more profits for them. Chinese have brought them in, and those ups and downs of those companies that go around with the ups and downs of an unstable capitalism have translated themselves into instability in the Chinese stock market. And likewise, their dependence on the North America, Western Europe, and Japan means that the Chinese are suffering from the crash since 2008 because their markets were hurt. They can't sell as much stuff because the mass of workers in these other places don't have the money they once did because there hasn't been the recovery that is claimed all the time. So the Chinese have serious problems coping with capitalist cycles, even though they are the kind of economy they are. So the crash of the stock market in China this last week or two should come as no surprise. This is a regular part of business. Does it mean that the Chinese will easily get through this difficulty? I don't know. No one else does either. They may figure out a combination of policies to get them through. They may fail to do that. Just like the United States has done a little bit better coping with the crash since 2008 than Europe. So if you look at the United States, you think, well, it's at least not as bad as it was. Whereas in Europe, it is as bad as it was. But whether China will be more like the U.S. handling this situation or more like Europe, time will tell. That's all. What we need to understand is, since China never really broke from capitalism, never created, for example, enterprises owned, operated by the workers themselves, didn't make that step. They didn't have the kind of break that might have allowed them to have a fundamentally different way of coping with the world. And likewise, they chose to be part of the world capitalist system. Perhaps you had no other choice, but in any case, they made that choice, and now they have to live with the instability as they are living with the inequality that comes from that. Be interesting to see how they maneuver from this point forward. I want to turn next to the other powerhouse, Germany. Germany is a completely different country, much smaller than China, obviously, but one with a very rich history that is haunting German life now. But I want to focus on the German economy. Germany is now the largest single country by population in Europe, as well as the economically largest and richest. It is a dominating economic member of the larger European economy. Its history has been an effort to become what it now is. At least from the time that the many different little countries that came together to make the modern Germany, and that's not very long ago, that's the 1860s and 70s, when Bismarck, the leader at that time, put together, overcame all the little countries that were there Prussia, Bavaria, and many others, and unified them using military force, by the way, a bloody program of unifying these societies into one country, Germany. Ever since that time, Germany has tried to develop its economy and found it difficult to do so because it was a capitalist economy they were trying to develop, and they had serious competitors. By far the one that bothered them the most in their first century was Great Britain, that had a jump on them, that had taken over huge parts of the world as part of the British Empire. The Germans never were able to replicate anything like the British Empire. And the United States in the second half of the 19th century also became a competitor. German economy got itself into conflict with Britain and the United States, tried to find ways to expand its economy, notwithstanding those conflicts, but failed in the end to manage that, producing staggering world wars. I'm not suggesting that the world wars were all Germany's fault. That would be silly. These were wars that brought in the United States, Britain, France, many other countries. Germany has part of the blame, but the blame game is not what I'm interested in, and I'm sure the blame is appropriately split among many. Germany did have the unfortunate result of losing, being the loser in both World War I and World War II. That saddled Germany with a new problem. Their industries had been destroyed in those wars. Large numbers of their young people in their prime of life, when they might otherwise have become productive workers, were killed or injured. And to make matters even worse for them, they were stuck after these wars with debts from the wars, the cost of fighting them, then the burden of losing them, saddled Germany with debts. And at the end of World War II, a final problem, the country was split in two. West Germany on the one hand, East Germany on the other. West Germany allied with the United States, Britain, and France. East Germany allied with the Soviet Union. So after World War II, 1945, West Germany, the bigger, more developed capitalist part, really had its work cut out for it if it was ever going to realize the German hope of becoming an important European and then global economic power, which is what they have sought for basically the entire existence of that society as a unified country. The first step they took, which is important as this story goes, was to say there's no way we can become an economic strength or strong country unless we get out of under our debts. In 1953, a few years after the World War II was over, they basically went to their creditors, the United States, France, and Britain, and said, if you want us to be a good ally against the Soviet Union in the Cold War, if you want to see us a strong, rebuilt Germany, well, you got to give us relief from these debts. Because with these debts, all our spare money, all that we could use to build our economy, is instead being paid off as interest and repayment of our debts. Give us debt relief. They made arguments very similar to the arguments Greece has been making for the last two or three years. Let us get out of the debt so we can rebuild the Greek economy and not be a poor backward country, but a regular part of Europe. The Germans got what they asked for. The United States, Britain, and France canceled half the debt that Germany owed, just forget about it, and stretched the other half out over 30 years. So the amount of money that Germany had to come up with each year was rendered nothing. Next to nothing. Number two, Germany, like China, decided to become an export economy. They could become powerful if they produced the machinery, the equipment, what they were good at for everybody else, starting with Europe, but hopefully globally. And they went to work to try to do that. In that process, they got two crucial assists that helped to explain why Germany has become as successful as they have. And this is not about Germans being hard workers. They are, but hard work by itself would have solved next to nothing. Or being ingenious. They are, but again, so is everybody else. Here are the two things that made all the difference. One, the commitment of Europe to unify, to present to the rest of the world a United States of Europe that could have some parallel to the United States of America, to get the economic strength, the political unity, and hopefully the solidarity that would avoid another world war, which was the terrible thing that they hoped for. And inside that unified Europe, Germany saw a chance to have a market that they could serve that wouldn't involve all the costs of going from Germany to Belgium to Italy to France, because it would all be one country, and the Germans pushed it. And they got a unified Europe, ultimately even a unified currency. And the second crucial thing that made Germany a success was the collapse of Eastern Europe, Russia, communism, and all that, because it unified West and East Germany. Suddenly, in 1989 and 90, East Germany collapsed as an independent country, was reunited with Western Germany. And in that process, the Germans got something. German capitalists got something that capitalists in the West, in the United States, Europe, never got, that the Japanese capitalists never got. What did they get? They get a highly trained, highly educated, highly used to industrial work labor force at very low wages, because that's what East Germany was. The communist government of East Germany had converted a largely agricultural into an industrial community. It had trained them and educated them better than in most other parts of Europe and had paid them relatively little. So they arrived as a cheap, highly trained, excellent labor force for Western German capitalists to use. Americans got Mexicans, hardworking, but agricultural, not highly educated, not technically adept. The Japanese got people from all over Asia, same problem. The Germans got a fantastic boost, and that gave them the wherewithal, the producer of Europe that could sell to everybody else. And when we return next week, I'm going to give you part two of the conversation about Germany to help bring it up to date. Because what Germany did with Greece was to undermine and largely destroy the very powerful unity that was so beneficial to them. And I'll explain to you how that is, why that is, and why that happened. Thank you for staying with me. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. Let me urge you again, please, make use of our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. I want to thank Truthout, that remarkable independent source of news and commentary. Check them out at truthout.org. And please, again, let us know what you think, whether you'd like us to come out and speak, whether you have a radio station that might like to carry this program. We do this program to be useful. Help partner with us to do that on a grander scale. Thank you very much. I look forward to talking with you again next week.